And we just have 30 seconds, but I was wondering if you could comment on the taking down of the statue of Frank Rizzo, the former police chief and mayor of Philadelphia, after it was defaced by protesters.
Yes, Amy. Well, that was a long time coming. Frank Rizzo was probably the most racist and most overtly fascist political leader in the modern history of the North of the United States. And I lived in Philadelphia during his period of time as mayor. He personally led police charges when he was commissioner, attacking black citizens, and his police systematically terrorized the black community. So for this Rizzo statue to come down is a real step forward in rewriting the history of Philadelphia.
Well, we want to thank Bree Newsom Bass for being with us, artist, anti-racist activist, and housing rights advocate. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up, we have the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. You can also hear us at K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Yes, well, these are funky times. Funky times, Joe. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. My name is Abe Proctor, sitting
and my name across Joe Uris, believe it or not.
It's Joe Uris,
yeah.
Okay. It's hard to know where to begin these days.
I'm overwhelmed. I'm actually overwhelmed, and I'm older, and I'm terrified. I actually think that we are cruising toward the worst bruising in our history, actually, in our history. And I don't... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to acknowledge you. I think you that's not an unreasonable fear.
I just keep... I don't like decrying. I don't like yelling the world's going to end tomorrow and all that and walking around barefoot with a cross on my back or something. But
you don't?
But gee whiz... first of all, I got to do some business. This is KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Abe Proctor over there, and me, Joe Uris, and we're actually on the telephone.
Indeed, we are. Yeah, and we've now introduced ourselves twice, so everybody knows who we are.
Yeah, and I want to tell people they can actually call to 231-8187. Things are a little funky because the station is operated on a skeleton staff of very brave people, and we're at our little old homes huddled down in fear, and that's only the beginning of the fear that I need to lay out on you. I mean, I have to say this. Look, in the midst of the coronavirus, in the midst of Black Lives Matter, in the midst of horrible murders of African Americans, which date back to the original slave operation, in the midst of all that, in Atlanta, a city which is considerably more black than Portland, Oregon, in the midst of that, two police officers find a guy, possibly drunk, asleep in his car, and what do they manage to do with this guy? Now, I want to say, in Toronto, they'd give him cab fare, but no. In Portland, Oregon, in Atlanta, they decide the best thing to do is handcuff him, and he, not only that, there's two guys, he's drunk, they can't manage to put cuffs on him before he grabs one of their tasers and runs away and tries to taser them. So what do they do then? Well, they have his name, they have his address, they have everything they need to come and get him at another time. But no, they shoot him twice in the back.
They shoot him dead.
Dead. Killing. Murder.
Murder. You know, I'm forced to wonder, at this moment in time, when police conduct is under more scrutiny than it ever has been before, you might think that police officers around the country might be making an effort to be on their best behavior.
Well, their best behavior is shooting people.
Their best behavior... Yeah, I take your point. Maybe not their best behavior, but certainly a regularly occurring feature of their behavior. So they shoot this man dead. You would think that they would possibly want to refrain right about now.
Well, you or I, of course, we couldn't ever be cops because of our attitudes, but you or I would say, oh, hell, we got his name, we got his address, we know where to get him, we stolen our taser, we can write him up on a grand theft, let's just let him go, tomorrow we'll come and get him when he's sober and rethinking things for himself.
Well, it's strange that you mentioned that you and I might not be cops, but... there's a conversation happening right now that's been happening in leftward circles for a long time now, but now it's happening everywhere. And that is, what do we mean by policing, and what sorts of people do we send to certain sorts of situations? And it might be that under the rubric of this new concept of policing, there might be room for people like you and me, Joe, whose first instinct is not to shoot somebody dead. And that in and of itself is a positive development.
Well, it is, and I actually know of stories in Portland of really good people who applied for the police department with recommendations from really other good people in the liberal establishment who were not hired in the Portland Police Department because the department's evaluation was they were not aggressive enough. Really?
I completely agree. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Portland Police Bureau right now, if I could.
Okay, let's do that.
Unless you've been hiding under a rock or holding up in your basement or whatever, you're probably aware of the protests that have embroiled Portland for more than 2 weeks now on a nightly basis.
Yeah, and I want to put something in here. I think this whole process of gathering in one location and moving to another so that the whole city sees a huge crowd in sequence is brilliant.
Yeah, it's good. It's good, and I have to say the demonstrators are doing a good job of documenting what they're experiencing so that we have evidence of these things happening from many different angles.
Yeah.
And when I say these things happening, what do I mean? Well, the protests have been characterized largely by violent police that seems to happen nearly every night here in Portland. Among the victims of police violence in our city are journalists. Friday night, Beth Nakamura of the Oregonian, a photographer, was assaulted from behind by a police baton after she had showed her ID, after she had identified herself as being part of the press, and after she was holding both hands in the air, one of them carrying her camera. I'm going to read a few tweets from Ms. Nakamura now. While covering protests, I was slammed by a baton from behind by police. Just before that, I was shoved hard. I'd made it clear I was pressed. Both hands up, ID in left hand, camera in right. This happened sometime between 12 a.m. and 1 a.m. Friday night. I was moving forward and away from police when it happened. Because it was in the middle of the block, I couldn't duck out. Amid the melee, there was simply nowhere for me to go but forward. Shortly after this occurred, another officer put her hand on my right shoulder, kept the others away, and escorted me to where I could finally turn left and peel off. So that's what happened. Now, this is not a solitary incident, I hasten to add. There's a number of journalists in the city now who have felt the sting of police violence to the extent that they have gotten together, drafted a letter and turned it into a petition on change.org asking the mayor to protect journalists and the First Amendment in Portland. I would like to read a little bit from that letter right now, if I can.
Please.
This is, as I mentioned, a group letter drafted by journalists working in and around Portland. Mayor Wheeler, we write to you in your role as Portland mayor and police commissioner. The undersigned are journalists, concerned residents of Portland, and concerned observers from around the country and around the world. We ask you to ensure that the Portland Police Bureau ceases assaulting and intimidating reporters. Violence directed at reporters has escalated over the past several weeks of protests in our city. While staff journalists at local outlets have been subject to violence from PPV officers, something you have spoken to, these heavy-handed tactics have also been used on independent reporters, who are often the last ones remaining to record PPV's tactics in clearing protesters from the downtown area. This distinction should not matter, but it is one that PPV have in recent days sought to emphasize. And then the letter goes on to describe in some detail a number of incidents towards journalists that have occurred over the past several days. I encourage you to go ahead and read the letter. Again, you can find it on change.org. And if you are so inclined, you can sign the petition there to encourage the mayor to do everything he can to put clamps on police violence here in Portland.
Well, good. I mean, I'm glad that the reporters are reporting, and I'm glad they're arguing. And I'm hoping that the change will come, but I have no great expectation. My experience with the police has been, in a long time in Portland, mixed. I've met a few people. I've actually, a couple of them actually ended up friends of mine. I met a few officers that I thought were sane, rational people, and I've often encountered in what I would have to call mobs of police terrible decision-making, vicious behavior. I saw the police at one point drive a perfectly reasonably quiet crowd in May Day of what was a 99, a long time ago, to the waterfront, so they were facing the river on one side and the police on three other sides, and then the police proceeded to shoot them with what they call less than lethal weapons. And people panicked, and they were worrying, and they were anxious, and they were actually... I think it's one of the real sources for the anger toward the police in Portland at that time, which still persists. It really removed from my mind any sense that the police were well-ordered, well-disciplined, and well-intended. And I cannot change that opinion at all. I'm sorry. I now feel, and I'm a happy old white guy, I now feel in danger when I see the police.
Yeah, indeed. Isn't that a nice little phrase, a neat little phrase, less than lethal? Isn't that nice?
Yeah, it's
really. That's like saying concentration camp is substandard accommodation. It's a little bit.
Yeah,
that's a nice euphemism. Turning now to the Willamette Week, which details in a news story that three very controversial weapons have been used repeatedly by Portland police against peaceful demonstrators in the past several weeks. They are gas, smoke, and other military-grade crowd-control devices. We're talking about things like rubber bullets and so on.
By the way, rubber bullets sounds like, you know, maybe like a little ping-pong ball. No, these will, if they hit you, bruise you, possibly cause internal injury, and conceivably break your skin.
Yeah, they're not anything pleasant. Tear gas, in particular, has been banned as a military weapon by several international treaties. But here it is being freely deployed against peaceful demonstrators here in Portland, and not just in Portland, all around the country. This is really, as you mentioned, Joe, this is really getting serious. There was one day last week that more than 2,300 people filed complaints with the city's Independent Police Review Board.
Really?
Yes, in a single week. And at least six protesters and a nonprofit organization are suing the city over its use of these controversial weapons. In particular, in their use of violence in general. So it appears that whatever characteristic seems to be prevalent among American police forces that leaves them predisposed to use violence against citizens, particularly citizens of color, the Portland Police Bureau is certainly not free of it. Because we're seeing it every single night on the streets of our city.
I mean, I just don't understand. I don't understand what they're being trained or not being trained to do. I don't understand why there isn't self-discipline, never mind the training, why there isn't rationality, why suddenly ordinary citizens put on a blue suit and are our enemy. You know, this is fascism in its direct, most immediate impact on the lives of people who are simply carrying out their First Amendment rights.
Indeed, and I think it's very, very important for us to mention right now that, unbeknownst to many, we're not talking about simply the Portland Police Bureau here in town. Here's Maxine Bernstein from the Oregonian tweeting, "The Federal Bureau of Prisons confirmed it sent a prison riot control team here to assist federal, state, and local law enforcement in response to protests."
Those are the thugs who put down riots in prison.
Yeah, they didn't ID their role. Oregon's U.S. Attorney's Office spokesman declined comment, quote, as it pertains to a law enforcement sensitive topic, end quote. Now, this mirrors very closely the phenomenon that's being seen in Washington, D.C., where uniformed law enforcement officers or soldiers or whomever they might be, I'm in doubt because they're not wearing any identifying markings.
Yeah, they're not even wearing the patches of their unit.
No, that's not stitched on the back of their jackets. They're not wearing badges. They're not wearing anything that would indicate who they are. These are simply black-garbed, riot-geared enforcers who are turning up to use these tactics on nonviolent protesters. This, I don't think I need to mention to our astute viewers that this is not normal in a representative democracy. This is straight out of the dictator's playbook.
I just want to say whether it is normal or not is irrelevant. It should not be normal in a democracy.
No, it is not. And as we can see, it is normal. It has become normalized. These sorts of tactics are being deployed all over the place. There's another dimension to this, too, that I've been really worried about since the beginning, and it really hasn't seemed to rear its head until now, and that is the prospect of violence between citizens. Now, last night in Albuquerque, New Mexico, a crowd turned out in front of the Albuquerque Museum with the intention of tearing down a statue called La Jornada, which is a statue of the conquistador who conquered New Mexico. And in the course of pulling down this statue, one of the protesters was shot by an armed militia member who had turned up as part of a counter-protest. Now, if the police violence doesn't get you scared, then this should make your blood run cold.
Well,
armed
especially when
turning violence against peaceful citizens. Go ahead.
Well, when everybody in the crazy world has like AK-47s or the equivalent, I mean, it is a society just aching for the worst kind of anarchy. And I'm not talking about a theoretical philosophical idea. I'm talking about crazy.
Yeah, this is a bad moment right now, and I really can't say with certainty when it's going to end or how it's going to end. The only thing I can say is I am considerably heartened by the speed at which the public has changed its position as regards the topic of police brutality. I mean, we're talking about a double-digit turnaround, depending on which polls you look at, in a course of just a few weeks, and this is absolutely incredible. It's even faster than the turn of opinion that happened around the subject of gay marriage a few years ago. And I remember at the time, those of us on the left who were observing this happen were remarking about just how quickly people came around on gay marriage. And this is even faster. So this gives me some hope, Joe.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling hopeful. I've always been a little bit cynical. You've probably noticed that.
No, yeah, I'm aware. I'm well aware.
Over the years. But the fact of the matter is that I'm both frightened in the same way you are, but also very, very disappointed, because I always think that there is a better nature to humans, that there has to be one. And yet our history, 400 years of enslavement, the decision to destroy ethnic communities within the boundaries of the continent, the brutality with which our system of prisons and reform is run, the way in which children are treated in many situations, the whole culture, the way in which women are assaulted in our society, all of it bespeaks a horrific fascist, and that's, I think, the right word, mindset that says, well, those people are the bad guys, let's get them.
Yeah, this is... You can't escape the feeling that we're really passing through the eye of a needle here, right? Seems like a number of threads of American life are coming together right now.
Wait, is that a Christian reference?
No, it isn't.
Oh, is it?
Should a camel pass through the eye of a needle?
Never mind.
Okay, yes, okay. It is a biblical reference, only instead of camels, it's people. Okay. And instead of camels, it's historical trend. Are you with me?
Okay. Yeah.
This is an inflection point in our history. All these things are coming to a head now. The inequities that have been laid bare by the coronavirus pandemic. Finally, the specter of police violence that has plagued our country for so long is receiving the attention that it deserves, and it would seem the sentiment from the public that it finally deserves.
Well, and go ahead. Well, I just wanted to, just in personal experience, when I have had a conflict with the police, I never had initiated it. I'm just kind of not the person who does that. I was actually brought up in terms of protests with a very strong tradition of pacifism. Beyond that, it doesn't mean you're not aggressive. It doesn't mean you don't make noise. It means you don't hit somebody. You don't threaten them physically. Anyway, I have had experiences with police that have ranged from perfectly reasonable to insane. I've been twice arrested for not doing anything illegal. Both times the courts threw the thing out. I have been hassled. I have been actually spied on. I all kinds of stuff, and it's all of it wrong, and all of it essentially un-American, and all of it a bad sign. And remember, I'm a nice old white guy.
It's true. It's true. You are a nice old white guy, Joe.
Yeah. Well, not so nice, but certainly white.
We have two callers.
Yeah, let's go to the phones. By the way, if you'd like to take part in this conversation, 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You can also write to us at the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AidandJoe. Caller, you're on the air. Good morning.
Brian.
Oh, yeah, hi.
Brian.
A little while ago, I think it was Joe, said something about the police conduct, and he said, you would think that with everything going on, they would, behave better. I think it's basically the gist of it.
Yeah, that was me. That was me. I said that.
Oh, that was you, yeah. And being a white male from the South, I think it gives me a little insight into the culture, probably, of some of these cops and people like Trump. Well, he's from the North, but he's the same thing. They are stubborn.
Well, he's a fascist pig. I don't think all the police necessarily are fascist.
No, but I'm talking to the element that are killing people now. You know, I mean, they have been, but the ones that these events that we hear about, they're going to double down. You know, they're like Trump. You know, when Trump gets called on something, his response is that he's never going to be embarrassed. He's never going to be sorry for his behavior. He's going to double down. It's like I'm a jazz musician, and there's a thing in jazz music where when you're improvising, if you make a mistake, if you hit a wrong note, you do it again just to let people know you meant to do that. And so,
right.
And so that's what he does. That's what these cops are going to do. This racism has been so entrenched all this long, they are not going to let go easy. In fact, if you call them on their BS, they're probably just going to do more BS to let you know that they meant to play that lick, right?
Right. No, I agree with you. I think there's some kind of very bad ego behavior going on when people are. I mean, it must have to do. I'm assuming that police are reasonably randomly chosen among society, although there's a tendency toward authoritarianism. But in the process of all that, somehow what they're being taught is not to serve, not to protect, but to punish.
Yeah, and to enforce this white superiority. You know, even if they don't say the words, they feel it. A lot of these people, and then so it's like right now, you know, people might be going out there thinking, hey, we're kind of a little bit safer because the spotlight is on them. And I don't know, sometimes I think if the spotlight is on them, they're gonna double down. So I don't know, that's not very positive.
Well, it's very scary. I understand your fear. You cannot be sure that there are legitimate humanitarian, that's the word I want, humanitarian limits to the behavior of the authorities when they apparently perceive themselves and are being encouraged to perceive themselves as the enforcement for the system.
Yeah, right. So then all eyes got to be open and watching out and watching each other's backs.
Cover your friends. I mean, you know, stay with, hook up with friends, and for goodness sake, learn to run away.
Yeah, running is good. Well, thank you for having this discussion, and I'll be listening. Thank you.
Okay, sure.
Hey, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Who's next?
We have Francis.
Who do we have next? Francis. Hey, Francis, good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Very well.
One good thing, to demonstrate what you were just talking about, I saw a clip the other day of a couple of police women asking to speak to that looks like they were in a barista or something, the manager, because they no longer felt safe coming in there because some of the employees were wearing Black Lives Matter pins, and that was intimidating to them as police officers. That is fascinatingly awesome that they would feel intimidated by the fact that people are saying Black Lives Matter.
Well, it is creepy, and it is weird. One of the problems that I think is social within the police world is the need for female officers. It's a felt need. It's also part of the culture to show that they can be just as arbitrary, just as mean, and just as righteous as their male brothers.
Yeah, I've witnessed that in Portland, and was amazed at how viciously cruel and racist this woman was, who was a police officer. One good thing, though, good note, good light. Remember Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who was the only person who voted against bombing Iraq. She and some other congresswomen have come up with discussion of something that has been a long time coming, of having a National Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And
good idea.
If that
good
can,
start. Good it, start.
Yes, it is. It's been a long time coming, and if they can get it off the ground in this climate right now, with the current administration, that's going to be difficult, but at least it's being discussed, and I think with persistence it can come to happen, and that would be absolutely marvelous, and there's no ends to what possibilities to what could happen from that, you know,
I think it's good. I want to thank you personally for giving us a little ray of hope and a little shot of light in this darkness. I think one of the things I want to do with this show between now and November is to talk about the long-term and short-term strategies of rebuilding, I want to make this clear, not rebuilding something towards socialism or a more just society, but rather rebuilding something resembling something like normalcy. Because right now, maybe nobody's aware of it, but things are really out of whack, and there is a fascist king with unlimited powers who has ignored the law, who is a thief and a criminal and potentially a killer in the White House.
And a sexual assailant.
And a sexual assailant.
Who pretends to care, and that's the most...
The one light at the end of his tunnel, is that he doesn't make any bones about the fact that he's a kind of a neo-Nazi.
Right. There is hope. There are people in Congress who still represent us, and hopefully they'll be heard.
I'm glad you brought that up. We have in Oregon, relative to the whole thing, a very good set of representatives in both the House and in the Senate.
And
they could be better, but they're not bad.
They could be better, sure.
Our city council is considering a budget that eliminates the unit that killed Keaton Otis and the transit police, and they've already eliminated the school police. So things are happening.
Indeed.
I think if we persist, as they say, we can get some changes for the better.
Well, I think
but
so.
But it's pretty.
I'm glad you're hopeful.
It's a quite intimidating time, though. And I think about
very
the children.
Scary.
Just one thing, you know, I think about the children and what they're and how they're viewing this, and just imagine their awareness. To hear constantly the assertion that their lives matter, when in actuality they should already be understood that their lives matter. And to hear it being repeated as if it needs to be continue to be said, because apparently they don't, that's pretty awesome for a child to have to accept.
No, you're right. I of course, I can't put myself in the mindset of a 9-year-old or something, but I find that this whole situation has got to be very corrosive, and people growing up within this situation either buy into some weird ideology or, in fact, become incredibly cynical and unable to act towards democracy.
I have witnessed myself a lot of young people who have become some of the most compassionate people in the world, and they're giving everybody the benefit of the doubt, and as I said, they continue to persist and stay in the higher ground.
That's really good.
Yeah.
Right. So,
hey, thank you for the call, Francis. Oh, go ahead, please.
I think we lost Francis.
You know, the both of you, Joe and Francis, were bringing up, I think, a very important point about how corrosive this is to the lives of people who have to bear the brunt of this. I had a conversation a few years ago with a colleague of mine, an African-American man, who told me how he had to sit down with his son and have a talk about how you behave when you encounter a police officer and what you need to do so that you can stay alive. And he said that his father had this conversation with him when he was a boy, and his father's father before him. Now, I've never had, I have two sons, and I do not have to have that conversation with them. That is a fundamental difference in the way that we move through the world.
Oddly enough, I have two daughters. They're grown up women now, but I remember having those kinds of conversations with them. Now, they grew up with a certain level of education and privilege that enabled, for example, the younger one, when hassled by the police in some nonsense over at Grant High School, she actually on her own learned how to go to court and how to argue that what the officer was charging her with on the ticket was nonsense, and won. But I was so proud of her. I didn't go with her. Her mother didn't go with her. She went on her own.
Imagine.
And that was very cool. But it's very, very difficult for people to do that. And she is a young woman at that time, a young woman who is part of the privileged, educated, white world. Imagine the same situation for a person of color. It doesn't.
Right. Yeah. The difference being that your daughter was really in no immediate danger of dying as a result of that.
Well, yeah, that's true. Well, I don't think so. I don't know.
No. Well, in comparison, I would say probably not.
Probably not.
A big part of the problem we've been looking at here is, and I've seen a number of really good pieces, some good journalism on this recently, is that across the country, on average, police bureaus, police departments consume a huge proportion of a city's discretionary budget. In some places, Los Angeles, for example, that number is routinely in the neighborhood of 50%. So half of the city's discretionary budget is going to law enforcement. So it's sort of like the old saw, right? If you have a hammer, all you have is a hammer, everything starts looking like a nail. And in a world of finite resources, it literally means that you're making trade-offs there. Every dollar that you spend on police is a dollar you're not spending on things like school nurses, school counselors, on social workers, on mental health professionals, and so on and so forth. But this is where we are. This is the current climate. This is the mindset. And part of that comes out of this long cultivated sentiment amongst a certain important portion of white America, which is that people of color are inherently dangerous, and the police department exists to keep our white communities safe from those unsafe people.
That's the historic role of the police.
Yes.
They were the administrators of punishment in the South and elsewhere.
Indeed, and we're going to get to that a little bit later in the show.
I want to put a name out there because I don't want to forget it. Kendra James. Do you remember her?
I do remember Kendra James, murdered by Portland police in the early 2000s.
Yeah, and what the police, I want to just make this clear, what the police strategy is, the city's strategy, well, there was an angry mob. Everybody was angry. Why was this woman shot because she tried to get away from the police. She should have been maybe taken down, maybe grabbed, maybe just find out who she is, since it was possible. No, no, they had to shoot her. And the excuse was she endangered the life of a police officer. The way a hearing was held on this was informally, and this is important. A black church in Portland was used as the site of this moment of outrage in the African-American and other communities, and the argument made there by the police, among other things, was, oh, we're in a church, you can't be angry.
Of course not. It's too soon after a gun massacre. We can't talk about gun rights right now.
Exactly.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that fits contextually into just what we're talking about here. And I was talking just a moment ago about the enormous amount of resources that are sucked up by police departments all over the country and the commensurate political clout that police unions have. So it is, I think, of note, and I think we should all take cautious optimism from this, that the three largest police unions in California, those in San Jose, San Francisco, and Los Angeles, this is according to the Sacramento Bee, just yesterday released a plan for internal reform that they hope will be adopted as a national plan. This calls for drastically reducing the number of uniformed officers on the street in their traditional law enforcement capacity and augmenting them by hiring mental health workers, social workers, addiction response people, and so on, so that we're not looking at the situation we look at now, which is where the first and only option for many cities is to send in armed police. So this is a step in the right direction, and one I think we should be cautiously optimistic about.
Yeah,
One of the reasons I say that is this is the police unions themselves acknowledging that they are part of the problem and that they need to open themselves up to internal reform. Go ahead.
Well, I think that's hopeful. I do think it's hopeful. I also think that what we have to remember, we really have to remember that the creation of a, I would call it a mock proletarian movement within the police, you know, the police unions and so on, was initially a thing of a positive nature that turned very quickly into an establishmentarian, empowered way of keeping the police safe when they do genuinely stupid and or bad things.
Go on.
Well, I think it's really important that we not make assumptions about the whole way in which the police system is structured. It's a deal. It's a deal between the ruling class and a smash you in the face class. And it's nothing else than that. Everything else that is put on the table is suspicious. From my point of view, I will never, ever, ever, ever believe that structurally people who are trained to capture and or kill people can be retrained to be social workers. I'm sorry, I just can't buy it.
We have two callers.
All right, let's go to the phones. Good morning.
Hello.
Hello?
Is it me?
Hello.
Yes, Robbie.
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the air, man.
I'm getting a lot of feedback. I'm hearing myself. Anyway, loved the conversation. Wanted to say, when you brought it up, I grew up in Arizona. I am Latino, of Latino descent, Mexican, Native American heritage. And I had, we had that talk with, like, groups of friends where, we were explicitly told, like, don't call the police unless you're skateboarding and you break your bone or something, but don't call the police until, you call a parent first, because the police aren't safe for those, communities. And so that is something that I feel a lot of people don't recognize when they're scared, when they hear, oh, wait, we're going to, disband the police department. They keep me safe. That's a part of the privilege right there. Is feeling safe with the police when there's people who can't. I wanted to bring that up, but also I don't know if you're aware, but a lot of the police officers, and I love that they're trying to I don't know, send social workers in and do the right thing. But I am also very cautious of reform. I just, that word alone kind of sends off red flags saying, you know, these are breadcrumbs we're going to get thrown, and then the liberals are going to be okay with it, and then we're going to move back to normalcy, which I'm not for. I'm not for normal. I'm not going back for normal. I'm here to make the change that's needed to have been made.
I totally,
you know, for the past.
I couldn't agree more.
No, I think I agree as well. I also think it's a little bit unfortunate to say to end the police. What we really want to do is to change the whole process of social care and concern within the society, and part of that, a very small part, is catching bad guys. The bigger part,
well, absolutely,
is helping people in crisis and getting them help that allows them to maintain their lives, support their families, and so on. That's what it should be about. But, you know, it's
exactly,
got
yeah.
a history. It's got a 400-year history to be changed.
Well, and yeah, exactly. Everything that you just said, I totally agree with. And you know, and that's the ultimate thing. When we say we're going to disband the police, we don't mean getting rid of, you know, somebody who's going to, you know, take out somebody with a hostage or, you know, whatever it is. It's just the first responders don't need a badge and a gun. You know, we need to have community people out there, which you're all for. I'm for too. But I was going to bring up one thing that if we do this reform, I find it very interesting. I was going down some rabbit holes. It's called Killology. There's basically most police departments use this one. I don't know if he's like an ex-Marine, some authoritarian, you know, murderer. He trains police officers. He has some class called Killology, and it trains police officers how to shoot to kill. Every police officer in America, you'll notice, they shoot to kill. When they shoot one bullet, they're shooting three at least till the victim drops. And that's something specific for America. In Germany, in other places, you know, I guess not, you know, South America or Brazil right now, but, you know, other countries that have police, a police force, they're trained, you know, if there is, you know, a mentally handicapped guy throwing axes or, you know, chasing somebody, they're trained to shoot in the leg. Just simple procedures that, you know, we don't see here. And, you know, and it's just, I wanted to bring that up for, you know, the listeners. So when we're having these discussions with family members or other people, we can be like, you know, why are police trained to shoot to kill? You know, they can't shoot a, you know, an axe carrying guy in the leg, you know, and, you know, tase him afterward. You know what I mean? Like, there's so many other options. The guy,
well, I mean, you know, in this latest fiasco in Georgia, I can hardly, yeah, presumably physically adept men could not handle a man who allegedly was under the influence of alcohol, who managed to get one of their weapons and run away and turn around and shoot at them. At the very least, it shows total incompetence.
Yeah, Robbie, it is called Killology. I saw a clip about this the other day. I'm really pleased that you brought it up. It's led by a guy named Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, and he gives these seminars and trainings for law enforcement people all over the country. And yeah, he's a pretty scary guy. In the video clip I saw, he was asking a room full of cops whether they are emotionally and spiritually prepared to snuff out another person's life. If not, they should think about another line of work.
Wow.
You know, comment that guy made? I'll take myself off the app here. But yeah, one of the comments that he made that really made me upset was he said, "After killing, you have great sex." He told cops that he said, "After you kill somebody, you're going to have great sex." Yeah. So this is the racism that's deep.
Wait, are we hearing links of murder with sexuality?
Oh yeah. Here, I'm going to read to you now from the definition of the word killology as displayed on killology.com. Here it is. Ready? Killology. Now, the scholarly study of the destructive act, just as sexology is the scholarly study of the procreative act.
Wow.
There you have it.
Hey,
yeah.
Hey, I love you guys. I'm gonna listen to you on the air. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Robbie. Appreciate the call. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program. Do we have any other callers standing by?
We have Thomas.
Yeah. Let's go to Thomas. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. This is Thomas. I'm over in Vancouver, Washington. Anyway, one thing, listening to you guys talk about this and other people on other talk shows, I always get frustrated hearing people focus on certain issues. You know, like in this case, the most, you know, overt one is police violence and all that sort of thing. And there are many others, many. The society, the culture is so screwed up, you can be running around in circles chasing all of these issues. And my frustration is that I don't see people, you know, the people yet being organized enough to really develop good strategy and tactics that are very effective. Joe can see this. When that group of protesters moves from here to there, to here to there, that drives the police crazy. That's a really good tactic, but there are many, many more of those. And what has helped me to see this, or to probably flame my frustration, is that I've read some things, commentary about Marxian theory of capitalism. And that capitalism, Joe says he wants to go back to normal, but I'm saying that this is normal. This is the normal for capitalism at this stage. All of this battling of these people in power with the proletariat, right, the working class, completely, totally normal, and they have no intention of changing anything. They want to maintain the system as it is. That's it, period.
Yeah, the use of state violence against citizens is not a bug of the system. It is a feature. It is operating as designed. We did not reach this moment by accident. We came here through a series of choices taken over a long period of time.
I want to just say I agree with that. My point is a strategy point. You're looking at the situation in which we have an onrushing, truly fascist national government under the leadership of a sociopathic madman. And you have to think about, oh, sociopathic madman, what do we know about those in history? That's what I'm talking about. That's the thing we face for real in the United States now. We're not talking about the potential for a great revolution, for great equality, for a better culture at all. All we're talking about, and I am very limited here, and I acknowledge that, but all we're really talking about is trying to get things to a place where we can begin to build democracy.
Yes, exactly. And you know, this is just one example. I've brought this up before on some of the shows on KABU, but there's this small book called From Dictatorship to Democracy by Gene Sharp. Now, he lays this whole thing out. Now, he's talking about going from dictatorship to democracy. Well, what the heck? We're practically there right now. And this book has a list of 198 things that you can do to do what? He said the goal is to make the system ungovernable in a peaceful way. Peaceful is very important because you will gain the respect of people that are on the fence about your issues. You will gain the respect of the police. They're beating you, but when these guys are human beings too, and they're watching themselves do this, and they go home and they look at their family and their kids, and all of a sudden, look what I did today. This is bad. It's like PTSD for the police, and it works on them. And one of these days, they're going to lay down their uniform and their gun, and they're going to walk away from it too. It is powerful, you know, Gandhi, those people. They knew that. And without that, it just isn't going to work. I live in Vancouver, and over here the police used to have that motto, protect and serve, on their cars. They changed it to valor, professionalism, and duty. It sounds like a damn SEAL team motto or something, you know? And they've dropped, I mean, they took those mottos off, that old motto off. Now it's real cutesy, VPD, you know, Vancouver Police Department, valor, professionalism, duty. And I looked at that and I thought, what the hell? I can just see the stormtroopers marching down the streets here, you know, with their little flags and everything. And it's pretty terrible. Anyway, thank you for letting me talk, guys. I appreciate it.
Sure. Yeah, thank you very much for the call. You know, what the phenomenon that the caller just described, the increasing militaristic tone taken by police officers, is also not an accident. And it's not just the tone that's increasingly militaristic. It is the armaments, it is the protective gear, and it is the vehicles that are increasingly militaristic.
And
again,
and the federal government gave them these tools.
Yeah, this was an outgrowth of the war on drugs. It started decades ago, and it involved a set of Pentagon guidelines and an act of Congress that started passing on surplus and used military equipment from the military to police bureaus and cities around the country. This is in the name of the war on drugs, but what it has led to is a law enforcement apparatus in the country that, in comparison to other wealthy nations, is incredibly well-armed, incredibly equipped, and incredibly dangerous. And
well,
it's not an accident.
No, I agree it's not an accident. I think one of the biggest problems we all face in this situation, there are two. The first is to understand the historic role of the police and where it puts the average police person. Not because they're a bad person, but because this is the structure they're in. That's number one. Number two, I think it's really important to assess the situation in terms of what can be accomplished in the immediate crisis we're in. And I'm going to be arguing, and people are going to get mad at me, I'm sure. I'm going to be arguing that the most important thing that has to be done on a national level at this point is to get the fascist out of office.
Yeah, you are absolutely correct.
We have Cassandra on the line.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Cassandra's on the line.
Cassandra's on the line. Let's
No,
hear from
not Cassandra.
Cassandra.
No, you're going to say something terrible about the future.
You have me pegged.
Please ignore my partner, Cassandra. Go ahead.
I agree with actually what he says. We do need to get the fascist out of office. Let's just start there before I say what I'm about to say. In order to get him out, I mean, the main reason to get him out is to start fixing all our problems. I think we can all agree on that one.
Yep.
But in order to fix a problem, you have to be able to acknowledge what the problem is, and you have to be able to see it truly and not fool ourselves. I listen to this over and over again, and I am reminded of a conversation I had. I'm 59. When I was 16, a lady from Auschwitz, survivor, came to my school and talked to us and basically pointed out that it's domination is the root of all our human evils. And with that, we have to understand, she was pointing out to the audience of students that those of us who might be more obvious, she was a Jewish, you know, survivor of Auschwitz. She said to the black students in the hall, to the Hispanic students in the hall, yes, you are the first people that will be, because she was fighting against the California Third Reich at the time. And she said, you'll be the most obvious ones to go first because you stand out. But this is about domination and hatred. And the domination breeds the hatred. And they have to turn their hatred against something. So when you are gone, they will then turn it on the next thing, and the next, and the next, and it just keeps going. So we have to start facing the fact that the root of our problem is not even, sadly, 400 years of enslavery, you know, in America, and 600+ years around the world, and 8 and 10, and actually, if you go back to biblical, it's in the Bible. There was slavery, although they treated them differently, and there were different circumstances, and it was a different attitude, but it was still slavery. It is the domination of one human being over another. And until we can start saying all we should be dominating is ourselves, controlling ourselves and not others, we will continue to see this reemerge over and over again. So when we start to build the new normal, we have to address the fact that this is globally, you know, you can go back to Roman age, and Christianity is born out of the ashes, as it were, from the, you know, the fall of the Roman Empire, and at that same time, and it inherited with its tendency to conquer, as did the Islamic, born from both the Judaic and the Christian, you know, the simultaneous sort of, but this sense of needing to conquer and needing to dominate. Not that this is pertinent or anything, but there is one group, one small, very small band of people left on this planet in Africa called the Akka, who who do not. They have no hierarchy. There is no male-female domination. They are the last hunter-gatherers that are the most egalitarian, and sadly, they are disappearing. With them, I feel we need to understand that it is possible for humans to achieve this, but only if we are willing to look at each and every one of us and start within our own family units and stop trying to dominate every action around us.
Well said. I completely agree. It is, okay, it is a struggle within oneself, ultimately, isn't it?
Well, I think,
yes.
You know...
And it's systemic. I mean, we talk about systemic, and this is the ultimate systemic problem.
Well, I think I agree with you, but I think part of what we run into here is a discussion of the nature of the beast, that is us.
Yes.
And fundamentally what we are. Fundamentally, human beings successfully conquered the world. Or they think they did, and it seems
they
so.
They think they did.
It's only nature that will turn us around in that sense. But I also think that we have the capacity for reason and compassion and planning. And all of that, because we are very bright animals, not bright enough, evidently, but because we are bright animals, we have the potential to look at ourselves and to examine our institutions and ourselves and to turn it around. But it's very hard to get people in that place where they're thinking in terms of the structure of the change that needs to take place and where you begin and where you do not begin and all of that. And that's something I think that we should all be talking about and thinking about. Yes, it's a good idea to create a policing system, I will use that word, policing system, that is concerned for the people and trying to solve problems and to de-escalate anger and rage and so on. All that's a very good idea. But in and of itself is not going to change the class structure and the power structure that dominates so much of the world and in which huge nation states become the leaders. And the leader of the leaders, I think, still is the United States of America.
Yes, and that's one of the main reasons also, I think, why capitalism is doomed, because it is a system of domination, and when we eventually sort through, if we are given the time on this planet, when we eventually sort through one issue after another, capitalism is an inherent problem.
Well, I agree, and I think one of the proofs of that is the fact that these huge corporations, particularly the energy industry, absolutely know, they have to know from the science, that what they are doing, what they are producing, will destroy, literally destroy, livability on the planet. And yet, they persist in this as if there's some magic bullet that will somehow appear from the heavens.
Because domination is a selfish inclination. The fact of dominating, you don't think of others. You don't think of even your own future. You think of the moment. It is ultimately the living in the moment with no regard for the future except the future to continue dominating. But even that, once it's gone, it's as though, well, I had my moment and I succeeded, and that's all that matters. And that seems to be also at the core of this dominating attitude. Anyway, I could go around for hours. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate the phone call.
And I'll stop teasing you about your name.
Barry's on the line. We have Barry.
All right, let's wrap it up with Barry. Good morning, Barry.
Oh, good morning. This is Abe, huh? Well,
it is.
Either one
I'm
of you,
too.
Both of you. Yeah.
We're both
either
here.
One of you or both of you. Huh? About the Israelis training the police. Did you know about that?
Actually, I do know about that. No, I do.
I
know that it's part of the multifaceted approaches that are used by the establishment to control populations. And because in Israel the authorities are very effective at controlling a liberation movement and a cultural movement, it has certain appeal. Yeah.
Yes, well, about a couple of years ago, a year or two ago, there was a large program put on at the United Methodist Church, and it was about Israel and the Palestinians, for those Israelis to train our police the way they interact with the Palestinians, that somebody would call in about this and talk about it. Okay?
Okay.
Yeah, thanks a lot then. You're very welcome. Thank you now. Bye-bye.
Yeah. No, I...
Thank you.
I'm not an expert on the Palestine-Israel problem. I do not think that the behavior of the Israeli establishment is representative of an ideal at all. I'm very disappointed and very ashamed by it. I think that it is a product of a terrible history. By the way, the history of the United States, though more successful in certain ways, is also the product of a terrible history. I think history, the things people do, is so important and so significant that we all need to think about exactly how we get to the places we're at, not just because there's bad guys or good guys or whatever, but because it's structural. And those structural reforms that are needed are very hard to build into a system. And that's the challenge we face. And in order to begin, we have to think about how do you peel away the bad stuff to get to a place where you have a chance of building democracy.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think, not to be pedantic, but I think by and large, we would probably be in a much better place right now if people had a more accurate awareness of how we got to where we are.
Absolutely.
If there was context, I think that would be enormously helpful.
Well, and we also have to acknowledge it's really important in a predominantly Caucasian society that we acknowledge the behavior of the European Americans in this continent. It's really important. We destroyed very healthy Aboriginal societies. We enslaved people for profit, and we kept that enslavement up long after it made any kind of sense at all. There was never any that much sense. You know, oh, indigo. Oh, tobacco. Oh, this is a way to get wealthy. It's bad. It's at the root evil, and that is something that we have